Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording just before midnight on the 21st of February, 2013. This is Nav Briefing 52 with the title Mephisto Rules, and it's the second briefing under that same title. As I say, it's pushing midnight here in Andalusia. The sky is clouded over. It's been a very rainy day with torrential rain coming down. There's a chorus of frogs outside, and I am at my outpost, the navigator's writing room, with my two faithful scouts, what appears to be my cat, Nikita, is flopped out on the navigator's notes, as she likes to do. And what appears to be my other cat, Rumi, is elegantly sprawled on the daybed here. I think he's got his eyes partly open. I think he's listening to the frog chorus, which is pretty strong. I just went down to the kitchen and poured myself a shot of Jose Cuervo tequila. And you can hear it tinkling. Having a little snort of tequila as I begin this briefing, I really need it to calm myself down. Staying calm and staying on the lower threshold of a state of manic excitement is part of my discipline these days. I know there are probably some people out there who think that I drink a lot. I'm drinking some tequila right now, and I would be hard put to remember the last time that I drank some tequila. I'd probably have to go back to Santa Fe, to Tomasita's by the railway station, a tequila sunrise, or a margarita gold on the rocks, no salt, thank you. And that would have been, what, now 9, 10 years ago. Occasionally I drink a glass of wine while I'm doing a briefing. You can hear the ice cubes clinking because I put ice in it. These Spanish wines around here are absolutely fabulous, and they have so much body and so much timbre. Timbre, T-I-M-B-R-E, I don't know how you pronounce that, you know. They have a kind of musical timbre that comes out of the mineral content of the earth here. My favorite wine being Finca La Estacada, that is the domain of the stag. And I do occasionally put down a glass or two of Spanish wine. I am known for downing a bottle of champagne on the occasion that some harlot shows up at the door. You know, the standing joke. Why do tantricas drink so much champagne? Because it's cheaper than water. But I'll tell you honestly, in case you're worried about me, as a Calica, you know, we love our addictions. I'm certainly not addicted to alcohol in any form. The truth is, and Kundry is my witness, she'll back me up on this, I'm a terrible, hopeless milkaholic. And over the last couple of months, I've been living primarily off a diet of milk and pickles. And that's the truth. I'm not making this up. I understand that's something that pregnant women ask for, you know, get me some milk and a big jar of pickles. Yes, I have been living off milk and pickles. I don't eat very much. I don't need to eat. But I do have an addiction to milk, and I always have for many, many years. Back when I was in my 20s and I was living in Santa Fe for the first time, I used to order milk from Nambe Farms. And that is a place. Nambe is a beautiful village connected with an Indian pueblo outside of Santa Fe. It's slightly to the north of the town of Santa Fe, Nambe. Now, of course, it's an enclave for the super, super rich. So I used to go dance at El Nido in Nambe with some of my various girlfriends at the time. And I had, I don't know what you call it, a contract. I had an agreement, can't remember what you call it anymore, with the dairy of Nambe Farms. An account, yes. And they would deliver milk to my door. I always remember the clink of the bottles. And I would order 3 half-gallon bottles of raw milk from Nambe Farms that would be delivered twice to my house. And the one particular house I had on Cortez Place at that time was where the milk was delivered, the doorstep of that house. And it was during a very, very cold winter in Santa Fe when there was a tremendous amount of snow, 3, 4, 5 feet of snow on the ground. And so in the early morning at 9 or 10 o'clock, I would hear the tires of the truck crunching on the road, and I would hear the clink of these bottles, and then I would crawl out of my bed, and I would collect these bottles. And the first thing I would do is I would take, have you ever seen what a half-gallon bottle of milk looks like? It has that, it has the top where you pour the milk out, the spout, the round spout, which has a little wooden, circular wooden tab in it. And the bottle itself is kind of rectangular, but it's big. Half a gallon of milk is a lot. I'd pull out that tab, I would grab the bottle by its neck, and I would guzzle down about half of the bottle for breakfast. Then during the rest of the day, I would walk around the place with my various girlfriends coming in and out. Jan was there quite often during those days. And I would be in my kimono, and I was writing something about astrology at the time, teaching astrology to a couple of people. And it was not uncommon to see me walking around the house, swigging out of a half-gallon bottle of milk like an absolutely degenerate and shameless addict that I am, you see. So if you want to know what I'm addicted to, if you think it's wine, you're wrong. If you think it's champagne, you're wrong. If you think it's good Jose Cuervo tequila, you're wrong. I'm addicted to milk, and I always have been. I guess I have that enzyme that digest milk, because we're not supposed to drink milk. Human animals are not built to drink milk. And some people can't, and I'm sure some of you are horrified to hear that I would even do this, But it's a matter of constitution, for one thing. I can digest milk. And a tantrika can eat anything. I could live off peanut butter and let's say Vienna sausages, which are really disgusting. No, I wouldn't. Okay, I could live off peanut butter and chorizo, which is a local brand of Spanish sausage, and milk for the rest of my life. You might have heard the story of, it doesn't matter what I eat, because I turn everything around. This is what a tantrika does. Only thing that matters to a tantrika in eating and drinking is to enjoy it. The enjoyment is the digestion. The digestion, the transmutation, is in the enjoyment. You might have heard the story of, Ramakrishna, who was a fanatic devotee of Kali, and he was trying to explain something once to one of his students. I was probably sitting there cross-legged in his ochre-colored rags, and he was trying to get across to someone of the power of tantric transmutation, and he like said, this is my paraphrase of the incident, but it's not incorrect. He like said, well, you know, the tantrika can eat anything. I think they, you know, he reached out and there was like a cow pat beside him, you know, maybe a fresh one, you know, because there's a lot of cow pats in India. And he reached out and it, you know, dug his hand into this cow pat and just gobbled down a handful of cow pat. You can eat shit. I don't happen to eat shit. But Ramakrishna demonstrated that it doesn't matter what you eat. It's how you eat that matters. And so, I don't know why I'm going on this digression. I just wanted to, I guess, finally confess to you, because you are my friends out there. We're getting pretty intimate in this Kalika magic stuff, aren't we? So I wanted you to know that I'm a shameless and degenerate milkaholic. And it has to do with the fact that when I drink milk, I get a direct hit in the back brain. I get a direct jolt of tryptophan. And that's why I am addicted to milk. It's a chemical fix for me. So, to get started with this briefing and move into the material, I'd like to make two leading observations. I'd like to frame up what I'm going to say next in a careful way. One of my observations is about your state of mind, you on the crew, and others who are picking up on these briefings, whether you be in planetary tantra but not on the crew, or whether you be neither. Anyone who is hearing these briefings in February of 2013 and in the subsequent months of this year, let's say between now and August, is living through a dramatic moment, a crucial and dramatic moment in the life of the human animal, and indeed in the life of the planet itself. Needless to say, that's not by any means a remarkable statement. Who could not be aware of the passage we are now entering on this planet, the events that are reaching a point of culmination? And to use that old expression, all hell is breaking loose. I mean, here we are in the month of February. The world is seeing the resignation of the Pope, which, as I've noted, occurs exactly at the moment that Not in His Image appears in its Italian version. A few days ago, I got an email from Germany regarding the possibility of a German translation of Not in His Image, and a day after that, a message from Poland. It doesn't surprise me, in a way, that there would be a kind of chain reaction effect from the Italian edition. As you may know, Dominique Guillet translated the entirety of Not in His Image, not a small task, I can assure you that, a couple of years ago, and that is available in French under the title La Passion de la Terre. The Spanish edition is also in the works, about halfway translated, the last I heard. I've got to follow up on that next month. And my highest desire regarding Not in His Image is that it finds its way into Russia. So for me, the opportunity for a Russian translation of this book would be a really fantastic moment in my life. So things are happening in the world at large of a tumultuous nature, and at the same time, The Sophianic vision of the mysteries and planetary tantra is in some way emerging. I give you the old metaphor of the dark horse. Somebody called me a dark horse once, the evening that he was introduced to me at a dinner party in Marion, Mass. And I would say that the moment of the dark horse has come. And I'm saying this because I want you to know that I sense your mood out there in the crew, those who are listening, those who are already committed to planetary tantra, and those who are considering it or dancing around the fringe. I sense your mood. And I would invite you to consider that with this practice of the GNE and with the dual practice of planetary tantra and Kala tantra, you are coming to see what it is to live in two worlds at once. You're getting the feeling, and it's a feeling of suspense, I can tell you that. My life is really, really suspenseful. And the intensity of the suspense is at times almost unbearable. At other times, less so. But there is an overall mood of suspense in the air now. This is not simply because things are happening on the large scale, such as the resignation of the Pope, the banking crisis reaching its final stage before everything goes bananas and so forth. No, it's not just that. I would say that the suspense you are feeling, along with me right now, is due to both of these things happening at the same time. It's not merely due to the external changes in the world, which everyone can follow, but it's also due to the hidden current operating within those changes. It's also due to the power and beauty of the Terma of Gaia awakening, which is breaking into the human mind. You might recall that's one of the first things I said a while back, or the first thing I said, I guess, in proposing the GNE, whatever else we can expect to happen, whatever else we can anticipate, the power and beauty of the Gaian mind is breaking into the human mind. And it does so like a tsunami wave in slow, slow, slow motion. So you might imagine this tsunami wave breaking now. And in this wave, in the tumultuous rush of this wave, coming from the heart of the planet itself, is all the destruction and mayhem and debris of a civilization going down in ruins. And I would say, continue with the surfer analogy, perhaps, that to be in the Gaian navigation experiment and planetary tantra is to be riding in the curl of that tsunami wave. And so you are feeling a little subdued and solemn. There's a solemnity in this moment. Think of troops in the trenches just before dawn, prepared for the strike at dawn. The strike of the Kalikas is a dawn strike. And just feel that quietness, that solemnity. There isn't much you can say at that in that moment of suspense. And so you've been rather quiet lately. I know that, and I know why. And I understand that what you're feeling is necessary for you to prepare yourself for what is to come. Now, let me speak for a moment of my second concern. Since I began talking about Mephisto, and even more recently, since the NAB briefing number 50, when I spoke of the highest desire of the Gayan Dakinis, I've been concerned that you might perceive that in some sense the NAV is taking the GNE in a direction that is not appropriate. You know, it's true that I've been speaking recently about the problem of Mephisto and about Calico War strategies. No doubt about it, the Calico War Party with Kali, Matangi, and Kurukula in the avant-garde is absolutely in the forefront of my mind, forefront of my life, and the forefront of my transmissions. And there may be a sense among you, which I could understand, a sense of hesitation or confusion. Well, wait a minute, why are we now suddenly in a Kalika War Party? That's another metaphor. I thought that we were in the navigational, on the navigation deck of the mothership. Well, it looks like from now on, you face the challenge to live these two metaphors simultaneously. I have not forgotten my duty to present NAV briefings that look at the apogee and perigee moments and discuss the particulars of navigation as I've done so far since this experiment began. I haven't forgotten that at all, and I promise you some of the NAV briefings to come are going to treat those matters. For instance, an overview of the upcoming perigee hits with particular attention to the one at the galactic center and the last one in the scales. The perigee hit in the galactic center occurs on March 5th, and the last one that touches the constellation of the scales, right where the claw of the scorpion jounces the left pan, occurs on March 31st. So I am certainly going to cover these and do as I have done before to frame up those moments for you. Also, obviously, there are some things to say about Channel 16, and you haven't heard from me on that subject for a while. It's high time for a particular and a specific NAB briefing on that, and I'm pleased to say that I have been thrilled by your own experiments with Channel 16 as reported on the forum. I couldn't be happier and I couldn't be more proud in how you have set up Channel 16 and attuned yourself by the tests that we have been running since last fall. So I want to thank you hugely for staying with that experiment and making it a priority to learn how to use Channel 16. I'm also happy that in the next briefing on that topic, I will be able to report an answer to my own question, which was just one of the questions that could have been associated with the testing of Channel 16, the test runs. You might recall that when I proposed the image of Picasso's dance with Banderillas, I also proposed a tentative syntax. It was only a provisional syntax. You all found your own syntax, and you did very, very well in that respect. But in that tentative syntax, I raised the question of the male and female polarities of divine imagination. What are they? And I'm happy to say that I can now describe them. And in a direct, in a concrete and vivid way. And that is something I am happy to do in a forthcoming briefing. So, for right now, bear in mind that I am super, super saturated with this Kalika warfare stuff. I have so much instruction coming from Matangi that I can barely make a cup of tea. I am at the limit of my capacity in transceiving Dakini instruction, which, by the way, is not in the least tiring or exhausting. It's extremely exciting, but there's only so much that my mind can hold at a certain moment. I feel compelled to cram these briefings with as much of the immediate Matangi intel as I can. So please bear with me. I'm grateful for your patience in that respect. So on that note, allow me to indicate in a cogent and explicit way two rules of strategy that you need to bear constantly in mind. Two rules of strategy that you need to know by heart so that you don't even have to think about them. They become intuitive or instinctual to you at every moment. The first rule is that you discern the enemy. You discern who is the enemy by seeing the difference between Mephisto, the trickster, who may be called the enemy within, and the true enemies of humanity who are walking around on the planet with you. Mephisto is not, as such, an enemy of humanity, although he can be called the enemy within. Mephisto is a material phantom or material archetype of a tulpa kind that commands great power within the human psyche. That is to say, in the psyche of the human animal, one person at a time, and in the collective psyche of humanity. If it were not for the presence of Mephisto in your own psyche, you and I would not be tricked into unconscious and unwitting complicity with the enemies of humanity. The enemies of humanity are external. The enemies of humanity are really out there. They are other people. And they are doing horrible and ugly things. And they have an agenda for the destruction of the human race and the devastation of nature and the replacement of this beautiful habitat by an archontic replica. This is really a characterization of the enemy. I've called them recently human vermin. You could also call them archontic vermin. And I'll get more into that distinction between sort of a garden variety human vermin and the archontic vermin, who are the real enemies of humanity. You distinguish by the first rule that the enemies of humanity are not the same as the trickster. Then you can begin to see what the trickster actually does. Let me give you a dramatic picture, as it were. Here you are standing in the ranks of the Kalika warrior party. And you're looking out at Kurukshetra, which is the battlefield and the charnel ground of the end of Kali Yuga. Hindu texts on Kali Yuga always describe the charnel ground, the cremation ground. It's a powerful metaphor for the breakdown of society and civilization. And you're standing there fiercely with your legs slightly parted. You're ready to slap your thigh and take your place behind those three powerful warrior women who are linked with their arms. And you visualize all that, and you're standing there, and you're looking fierce like a warrior, you know, like one of those Maori warriors, those fantastic tattooed dudes who scream and who exhibit such a fantastic threat display. Threat display, by the way, is an important Matangi strategy coming up soon. And you're all ready to go. You're all ready to engage in the battle. And then what happens? Suddenly it's like there's a fog or there's a mist. There's a mist that comes over your eyes. And then you can't see clearly anymore. You can't see exactly where those powerful Dakini forces are deployed. You can't see exactly who's who, and vision gets blurry, and your mind starts to wobble, and you're tempted to go down one rabbit hole or another rabbit hole in search of the enemy and try to identify the enemy and try to figure out what's behind the conspiratorial, labyrinthine machinations of evil that are happening all around you, you know, and you get lost. Get lost because Mephisto is putting a mist in your eyes. Because that's what Mephisto does. And because Mephisto puts a mist in our eyes, it becomes possible, obviously, for those enemies of humanity and the monsters who orchestrate social evil to operate right under our noses and to operate all around us and take us down because we don't have the warrior clarity to see with knife-edge precision just exactly who they are and what they're doing. So you see, that's the game. That is the way that Mephisto, who is the trickster and the enemy within, collaborates with the enemies of humanity, who are human animals just like you and I, although they are in a state of depravity and decadence that is almost inconceivable. So know the enemy and know the tactic of the trickster. The smoke and mirrors of Mephisto, which he uses to cover the actions of the enemy. This is the first rule of engagement. Second rule of engagement is hold formation. Know where you are in formation. Now, the formation of the Kalika War Party is not just a metaphor that John Lash happened to invent for one reason or another, or it's something that just happened to come about as an imaginative exercise from the practices of planetary tantra. This formation of the Kalika War Parties is an actual configuration of human forces within the vital and erotic body of the planetary animal mother. Can be compared to a V-formation flock of geese. In fact, I think that's an excellent comparison. I just thought of that. Picture a flock of geese in the sky. Look at the way that they assume this V-formation and the way that they each fly individually. Each bird is independent, but they maintain the spacing of the formation. They maintain the same tempo of flight, even the same altitude of flight. And they all fly in the same direction, not because they are acting in a zombie-like imitation, as we see in mass or herd behavior of human beings, in shopping malls and parades and things like that. No, they fly as individual animals in a group formation, because there is something mysterious about the power of that formation. It is what could be compared to what Arthur Koestler called in The Act of Creation a morphogenetic field. Now, this science of the morphogenetic fields goes back to Romanticism, and it is part of the true science to be recovered with the discovery and collapse of the false archontic paradigms of science that have been enforced upon the world, such as thermodynamic theory from Sadi Carnot, quantum theory, quantum mechanics, relativity theory, string theory. All of this crap has been foisted upon the human mind. You have to go back to the beginning of the 19th century. You have to go back to the time of Goethe, who was still living at the beginning of the 19th century, the early 1800s. Goethe's science of morphological observation was the basis of what later emerged as the paradigm of morphogenetics. So there is such a thing as a morphogenetic field. And in fact, nature is nothing but a set of interacting morphogenetic fields. But the difference between the morphogenetic field of a human animal and the morphogenetic field of other kinds of animals and birds and insects is that in the case of the non-human animals and creatures, the totality of that species has its own singular morphogenetic field that applies to each separate animal or bird or insect in that species, whereas every human animal has its unique morphogenetic field. And this is a teaching that comes from Chinnamasta, interestingly enough. I received this instruction about the morphogenetic field of Chinnamasta, of humanity, of the human animal, from Chinnamasta, whose teachings are extremely fascinating and extremely difficult to retain. But I am able to retain and to rephrase something that I received in a Chinnamasta shift, and it goes like this. The geomagnetic and bioelectrical field of the Earth, which is the vital erotic body of the planetary animal mother, is grooved. And the groovings are the tracks of operation of various morphogenetic fields. These grooves, upon occult observation, might be compared to the organization of the great bands of emanations of which Castaneda spoke. The great bands of emanation are the fibers and the hairs and the massive currents in the bioelectrical magnetic body of the Earth. But these massive bands of emanations of the planetary animal mother are configured by the presence of her creatures in those bands. So, for all creatures except the human animal, the morphogenetic operations of a particular species, a swallow, a whale, the geese in the V formation, the morphogenetic operations of the field that comprise that species holds all of the particular creatures of that species in one groove. Rifling is the word that I received in the Chinnamasta instruction. There's a rifling in the geomagnetic field of the Earth. Every species has its own rifling. But the individuals of those species do not have their own rifling, except for the human animal. Every human animal has his or her own rifling, or morphogenetic track in the body of the planetary animal mother. Now, just in case you're not entirely certain what rifling is, R-I-F-L-I-N-G, there's an excellent article in Wikipedia. It shows the view down the barrel of a rifle, a 105mm Royal Ordnance tank gun. You should take a view down the nose of a tank gun. That's a good way to learn about your own power as an animal generating and propagating a morphogenetic field in the body of the planetary animal mother. And it's much better to look down your own rifling and be in your own rifling than, obviously, to look down the barrel of a 105mm Royal Ordnance L7 tank gun. The Wikipedia article says, rifling is the process of making helical grooves in the barrel of a gun or firearm, which imparts a spin to the projectile around its long axis. This spin serves to gyroscopically stabilize the projectile, improving its aerodynamic stability and accuracy. Now look at this article. Now, I was floored, totally floored, on the two occasions, both the occasions when I have been able to stand 10 minutes of Chinnamasta instruction. You know, Chinnamasta is the self-beheading Mahavidya. And so you have a picture of her standing there with her head cut off, and she's holding the head in one hand, and two spouts of blood are coming out of her neck, and her two devotees are standing on the right and left drinking this blood or receiving it in cups. What's that all about? Well, if you can get close enough to Chinnamasta, which is sort of like petting and necking with a welding torch, if you can get close enough to her, she instructs you, as she did me, in what is called the mysteries of the central channel. You recall that I said that I received a mind mandate transmission from a Nyingma master or Rinpoche. That was in the mid-80s in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And at that time, in the half hour I spent in audience with that Lama, I received the entire download of magical and metaphysical teachings of the whole Nyingma tradition, the whole kit and caboodle, the total enchilada, the whole nine yards, call it what you will. When I underwent the first bout of Dakini instruction with Chinnamasta, she laid me out flat in a New York minute by showing me that I could talk about the most arcane practices and secrets of Tibetan Buddhism in an entirely new way, that I could take the material belonging to the highest level of those practices, which is sometimes called Ati Yoga, and turn it right around and convert it into something entirely new in the framework of planetary tantra. And one of the first things she showed me, and I can't tell you how astonished I was like shaking for days. She showed me that the so-called central channel, of which these Tibetan masters make such a big deal, is not a mysterious channel in the subtle anatomy of your body. It's not inside your body at all. She showed me that the model that they have used for a long, long time of the spinal structure with its central channel, called in Hindu the Sushumna, and then the Ida and the Pingala currents to the right and left, is completely obsolete. And she showed me how to externalize all that. And in fact, the primary impact of her first instruction to me is blood simple. I can communicate it to you right now in one sentence. You are in the central channel. The central channel is not in you. Got that? Go look it up, central channel, Nyingma, Tibetan Buddhism, blah, 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 and yada, yada, yada. It's all over It's all over, folks. There is something better than that. There is something truer than that. Because Planetary Tantra takes all that was in that tradition and converts it into a magical physics of erotic and cognitive power. The central channel is the rifling of your individual morphogenetic field within the geomagnetic and bioelectric body of the Earth. It's your rifling. You have your own rifling. You are in the central channel. It is a groove that you walk in. Wherever you go in this world, you cut a groove in her field by the operation of the morphogenetic properties of your vital energy. So, to get back to the Kalika warrior formation, go and look at the flight of geese in a V formation. And while you're contemplating that, go in turn and look at that marvelous YouTube clip about the murmuration of starlings. Now, you see this vast, vast, vast flock of starlings, and they are all flying together, and they seem to be making these kind of figure eight or toroid shapes, like a Mobius strip, right? It's a torquing, twisting, beautiful torquing, twisting mass of starlings flying together, imperfect, every one of them perfectly independent, no one of them in any way interfering with the flight of the other. You never see one of the birds, not even one, fall out of the flock because it runs into another one, do you? This phenomenon, which has been studied by science, and I see here that there was an article in Wired magazine called "The Startling Science of a Starling Murmuration." So, obviously, science has studied this. I don't know if that article says anything about the morphogenetic field. It should, because what you're seeing in a murmuration of starlings is the ecstatic joy of those individual birds as they surrender into the power of the morphogenetic field that encloses them and holds them as a single species. They only have one morphogenetic field. That entire murmuration of starlings only constitutes one groove, one rifling, rippling groove in the body of the planetary animal mother. But it is obviously powerful, beautiful, fluidic, coherent. The difference between the murmuration of starlings and the V formation of geese is obviously a difference of focus or direction. There is no particular focus or direction with the starlings. There is an unmistakable focus and direction, aka intentionality, with the geese. What you are seeing in those two examples are two properties, outstanding natural properties of morphogenetic fields. One is intentionality, and the other is the ecstatic or Dionysian power of release. The planetary animal mother endows in all of her creatures behavioral properties that allow them to experience the particular qualities of emotion that are specific to their morphogenetic field. And you see that by the behavior of flights and flocks of birds, flamingos, monarch butterflies, the migration of dolphins, massive pods of dolphins. Someone sent me a link recently about a huge pod of dolphins. All the dolphins have one morphogenetic field, but it gets even better, folks. It gets even better. because the articulation of these morphogenetic fields within the body of the planetary animal mother is so beautifully conceived. It is conceived at the level of the highest art imaginable that goes far beyond the greatest artistic achievement of the human mind. By that I mean that Gaia Sophia, in the dreaming of her animal species, configures the morphogenetic fields of each species in an entirely different way. They are like different styles or different strokes of her brush. And so what we find is that in some morphogenetic fields, such as that of dolphins, within the singular rifling of the dolphin species, there is a sub-rifling of particular animals, particular mammals, or dolphins. That accounts for the fact that you find a high degree of apparent individuality in the life and behavior of dolphins. They are still comprised within a singular morphogenetic field assigned to that species by the dreaming of the animal mother. But within that field, they can, as it were, approach a singular rifling in the way that a human animal does. Another example of that would be solitary animals. Take, for instance, the Andean puma. Now, the Andean puma is not an animal that travels or lives in herds, obviously. It's an extremely solitary animal, like the snow leopard of the Himalayas. And what you see with animals like the snow leopard is, again, a further elaboration of the high artistic finesse of Sophia's dreaming. So, all snow leopards or all Andean pumas belong to the same morphogenetic field. They only contribute one band of rifling into the body of the planetary mother. But within that band, they again have the opportunity to propagate a unique signature. So if you were able to observe the morphogenetic band, say, of the species of snow leopard, and you can do this, by the way, to observe that band by an ecstatic trance perception of the earth, you would see that within that band there is something like curlicues and paisley. And that these curlicues and this sort of rippling effect within the general morphogenetic band of that species represents the presence in that species of solitary animals, animals who are capable of a high degree of solitary psychic and emotional and cognitive and cognitive behavior. Now, when you come to the human animal, you get the extreme degree of this phenomenon of individual rifling. The human animal is the only creature in the realm of Sophia's dreaming on this planet in which every single creature of the species has its own rifling. Now, that's a problem with that. You can well imagine what it is. And there is also a challenge and an opportunity there. And the opportunity is that we as human animals would configure ourselves intentionally into a morphogenetic field. We would, in fact, generate a morphogenetic field by a formation that we make. We make this formation, and heed this well, my friends, from the current of your life. It's the current of your life that runs in the rifling of your morphogenetic field as a human animal. The current of your entire life. And so, by dedicating your entire life to the Aeon Sophia and joining with other people who do the same, human animals can, in effect, construct the morphogenetic field similar to that that is given to the divine by the divine Sophia to other animal species. We have to construct ours. Because the degree of individual specification of our rifling is so high. The calibration of our rifling is so fine. In fact, she can identify every single human animal by the signature of its rifling in her body, by the vibrational signature of its rifling. She can follow and track every single human animal as a single creature. So what you're getting some picture now of what is the Kalika, the war formation of the Kalika Party. It is the beginning of that morphogenetic field to be shared, the shared morphogenetic field. They do not call it collective because it is not a phenomenon of collectivity. It is a phenomenon of selectivity and of a formation that is not a hierarchical formation. It is purely an energetic, an aesthetic, and erotic formation of human animals into a wedge-shaped warrior party consisting of a number of staggered Vs. And when I say, hold the stance, I mean know where you stand in that formation. Now, so far, you don't really know that. You can't know that. You're just beginning to know. So far, I've only described three Vs, haven't I? I've said that behind Kali is the V formation of male Kalika warriors. That's central. Behind Matangi on the right flank is the V formation of female Kalika warriors. And behind Kurukula on the left flank is the Motley Crew, the V formation of male and female warriors alike. But that is only three out of the 16 active modalities in the Shakti cluster, excluding 17, which is the flashpoint or lightning rod, and excluding 16, which is the channel 16. Oh, and also excluding 18, because VV is not comprised in any one of these triangles. So you take 3 away from 18 and you get 15. So actually, there are 15 wedges in the total formation of the Kalika Warrior Party. And so far, 3 have been defined. And everyone who comes into the party can know exactly which flank they occupy and which wedge, which V formation inside that flank. Now, get this picture clear. You might want to sketch it out on a piece of paper. By flank, I mean the array of V formations in levels standing behind Kali, Matangi, and Kurukula. So far, I have defined the first flank. There are 5 flanks. In other words, the Kalika War Party is 5 layers deep. Okay? And the first flank consists of those warriors who have Matangi as their guardian, female, men who have Kali as their guardian, and men and women who have Kurukula as their guardian. You go into Kalika war engagement with your guardian and knowing your guardian. So obviously I am due to talk more about the process and the ritual for identifying your guardian. Now, I have someone who wrote the other day and said, well, I think my guardian is Idris. That would be Mar, my friend from Majorca. And someone else who wrote today, Janet, saying, I think my guardian is Visvamata. Okay. If these are, and I hold these to be correct, if these are the case, well, where is the V formation of warriors with Visvamata as their guardian? Where is the V formation of warriors with Idris as the guardian, and so forth and so on. And that's all in Kalika War Strategy. It is all coming from the Dakini instruction of Matangi as I speak. So I'm not going to elaborate on it now, but I'll just give you a peek. Behind the three V formations so far defined, there are two V formations. So if you picture those as three Vs with the points standing upward, you can draw that on a piece of paper. Below them, in the space between the Vs, there are two spaces. So in the space between the V of Kurukula and Kali, you place another V. And in the space between Matangi and Kali, another V. And that's the second flank, or rank, I guess you would call it rank. It's the second rank or layer with a right and left flank. The left flank comprises warriors whose guardian is Shodashi. The right flank comprises those warriors, men and women, whose guardian is Bhairavi, and so forth down the line. Coming into the third flank, there's only one V in the third flank. Can you picture that? You have the three Vs like teepees, right? Then you have two teepees below them, second rank. And then you have between the Shodashi V and the Bhairavi V, you have a single flank. And then it goes on from there. That's the third flank. There's one V that holds the third flank. And so the functions of these positions are absolutely exact. You not only know exactly who the enemy is within, that is the trickster in your mind, and who the enemies are without, but you also know exactly where you stand in the warrior party. And I tell you today, it is now 4 o'clock in the morning on the 23rd of February, 2013. If you stay in this practice, if you continue in the commitment to planetary tantra and observe the Terma of Gaia awakening and find yourself in this warrior party, you can have absolute courage and confidence in your life no matter what happens. First of all, you're not alone. Second of all, you are under instruction, not only from your own particular guardian, but you're under the instruction of the whole array of Kalika warriors. We all learn from the instructions and strategies being learned by other Kalikas. But beyond all that, take this visualization with you. Take it into every day of your life and master it until you can recite it in your sleep, because that is when a lot of this Kalika warfare is performed in sleep. Take this, what I'm telling you right now, and impregnate your mind with this, that the Kalika War Party is the formation of an integrated morphogenetic field aligned to the Aeon Sophia. And the individual human animals in that configured morphogenetic field command her according to her highest desire. The magical act of commanding a Dakini is so powerful that it is impossible to handle it alone. Although you can in flashes and at moments, and I have done that. But let's recall, as I close this briefing, let me call to your mind the observation that VV, who is morphing into her seventh identical node of lucid dreaming, does not correspond to any one of these V formations. She carries them all in her body and they are like organs and instruments of her own will and volition, of her pronoia as an aeon, of her autonomy and her sovereign power. These V formations are instruments of the pronoia of the planetary wisdom goddess. And human animals in these formations hold her life and her intention for all of life in a morphogenetic field that we ourselves are propagating. We are propagating it in real time. And the power of this morphogenetic field, the 15 V formations in the total Kalika War Party, is like nothing the world has ever seen. It has never occurred before. It has never been achieved before, either in this Kalpa or in any previous Kalpa, during the experiment of Anthropos 10. So take that to bed with you and dream on it and wake on it and live with it. And be assured that you have my comfort, my confidence, that you can realize what I'm telling you. You can realize it just as well as I do. We realize it together. It is emergent. It is co-emergent in our minds right now. I cannot teach you anything that I am not myself learning in real time. And you likewise can teach me the complement of what I am learning by what you are learning. And this is the mission, this is our joy and our passion. If you desire to accept it, you know, remember the old series? I used to watch it all the time, you know, Mission Impossible. But this is not Mission Impossible. This is Mission Possible. This is Mission Wonderful. This is the sorcery of love and intention.